Bonjour tout le monde, bienvenue à cette première séance du colloque Stratégie pour le journalisme. Et comme en toute chose concernant le journalisme, tout est sujet à controverse, on doit quand même commencer par les questions de définition. Ça a été abordé hier soir, de quel journalisme on parle et qu'est-ce qu'on entend par journalisme. Donc c'est le thème de notre premier panel, les définitions ad hoc. This morning's first panel is called Working Definitions, as in probably the most basic and contentious issue concerning journalism is what is journalism and what kind of journalism are we talking about here? So that's kind of the theme of this first panel. For anyone wanting to follow in another language, I guess there's going to be a whisper translation at the very back of the room. So if you want to, if you don't feel uncomfortable assuming, showing your unilingualism, if you want to, if you think you're more comfortable following a French paper in English, you can follow that whisper translation at the back of the room. I've never experienced that, but apparently it's very efficient. Je traduirai pas ça, je pense que tout le monde, les francophones, comprennent très bien l'anglais. Donc, je vais simplement vous présenter l'animateur de cette première séance, mon collègue à l'Université du Québec à Montréal, Jean-Hugues Roy, un ancien journaliste à Radio-Canada, un innovateur techno, un visionnaire des changements du journalisme, donc personne toute désignée. Jean-Hugues Roy is my colleague, professor at UQAM. When he's not teaching, he's covering student protests with his camera in hand and getting on the ground. So he's a very innovative and very visionary type of journalism professor. Voilà.
Oui, oui, I'm Colette, embarrassingly enough. Thank you very much for being here. Merci à tous d'être ici avec nous dans cette magnifique maison, in the wonderful Thompson House. And I want to thank you, yes, for being here. And I want to thank also the student movement for allowing me to be here, because normally on Fridays I teach. So, but yeah, as Colette says, this conference lays the foundation of the whole, this panel lays the foundations for the whole conference these coming days. I want to introduce our four panelists today. D'abord, il y a M. Robert Hackett et Mme Pinard Gourlayan qui vont nous parler, qui vont poser une question fondamentale. Ils nous demandent à qui a besoin de l'objectivité. Alors, M. Hackett est enseignant à l'École des communications de l'Université Simon Fraser à Burnaby, en Colombie-Britannique, depuis 1984. Il co-dirige aussi un site très intéressant, un observatoire du journalisme qui s'appelle Newswatch Canada depuis 1993. Il est l'auteur de nombreux ouvrages sur les médias et sur la politique. Son dernier s'appelle « Expanding Peace Journalism » notamment. Et Pinard Gourlayan est doctorante à l'université, donc Simon Fraser aussi. Donc, il se demande, ce principe fondamental qui est l'objectivité, est-il encore pertinent aujourd'hui en temps de crise? On va ensuite entendre M. Greg Nielsen, qui est dans la salle ici, oui, qui est à l'Université Concordia. Il dirige le Centre d'études en radio-télévision, le Center for Broadcasting Studies. Il est professeur de sociologie, donc, à l'Université Concordia. Et M. Nielsen va nous amener à réfléchir. Vous savez, quand on enseigne le journalisme, when we teach journalism, we always say, ask our students before they write, you know, write for your grandmother. Okay? But in doing so, Mr. Nielsen is also going to ask us, journalists, who do we exclude through this process? Donc, qu'est-ce qu'on exclut? Alors, il va nous amener à réfléchir donc sur ces mécanismes d'exclusion qui sont imbriqués dans la presse à Montréal, à New York, mais le sujet l'a intéressé. Il me racontait tout à l'heure qu'il a étendu son champ d'investigation aussi à la presse à Los Angeles, Miami, Toronto et Vancouver. On va ensuite avoir deux représentants de Groundwire, une expérience très intéressante qui est en ligne depuis 2008. Il s'agit d'un magazine radio qui est diffusé toutes les deux semaines dans une trentaine de radios communautaires et universitaires à travers le Canada, de Halifax à Nanaimo. La plus récente édition, je suis allé voir, ça a été produite. Et ce qui est intéressant, c'est qu'elle est produite à chaque fois par une équipe, je ne sais pas si c'est à chaque fois, mais il y a des équipes de production différentes qui produisent les émissions. Et la plus récente édition, par exemple, a été produite par la coopérative radio de Kootenay, à Nelson, en Colombie-Britannique, sur le territoire de la nation Sinicht. Alors, les défis, ils vont nous expliquer les défis de qu'est-ce que ça représente comme défi de construire un réseau d'informations communautaires au Canada. Ils ont une expression, eux, que je trouve très intéressante, c'est pas des radios communautaires, mais c'est « community-centric ». Alors ça, ils vont nous expliquer tout ça avec des exemples, je crois qu'on va pouvoir entendre. Et on va terminer avec M. Robert Washburn, qui est professeur au collège, au Loyalist College de Belleville. M. Washburn va nous parler de l'information, en fait, des nouvelles hyperlocales en Ontario, plus précisément sur un site qu'il a construit lui-même qui s'appelle Consider This à Cobourg, une communauté qui est une heure à l'est de Toronto. Il va nous parler des défis de viabilité d'un tel site hyperlocal, mais aussi des quelles sont les politiques publiques qui pourraient être recommandées pour soutenir des initiatives comme celle-là. Alors, chacun des invités, each of the panelists will have 10 minutes. I have my chronometer, but je vais être flexible. So, Mr. Hackett.
Okay, thank you very much. First of all, I would like to thank the organizers of this conference for their initiative and imagination. And I also would like to bring greetings from the organizing committee of Media Democracy Day in Vancouver, where it is currently 6 o'clock in the morning. So I hope you don't mind if I remain seated and conserve my energy. I'm just still dealing with the jet lag situation. Yesterday, Mark Raboy nicely put it that journalism is in a state of environmental decline. And indeed, it may well, he said, be in its global warming stage. And I think that that metaphor is more apt than he may even have intended, because I think that there is a link between the current crisis of journalism, the aspects of which we are now all aware, you know, its legitimacy and credibility being called into question, its problems of economic sustainability, cutbacks to public service broadcasting, the decline of the public service ethos, and so on, declining and fragmenting audiences that are less interested in political engagement than were previous generations. I think there's a link between the crisis of journalism and our collective failure to act and address and act upon the other serious crises that face, frankly, global civilization. And I'm referring, obviously, to environmental and change and climate, the climate crisis. But also increasing violence that may result as we have more and more resource wars, we have stateless refugees and economic migrations, financial instability and periodic meltdowns, globalized inequality and poverty. This is a great way to start a conference, isn't it, at 9 o'clock in the morning. But that's the situation we're in. And if we're going to get out of it, to even have a reasonable hope, you know, better than the Vancouver Canucks' chances of making it into the second round of the playoffs, then we need journalism to help us, to orient us, and to not to act as a movement, but to help focus attention and prioritize the serious problems that global civilization is facing. So we are arguing that journalism should be reoriented as a self-reflective crisis discipline that accepts an ethical obligation to help inform, engage, and empower publics vis-a-vis these critical challenges. And in a way, it's an extension of one of the liberal rationales for a free press, that is the surveillance of our physical and institutional environment, the so-called watchdog function. Identify problems, alert us to them before they become unmanageable crises. So in this paper, very briefly, we're going to be considering peace journalism and environmental communication as emerging paradigms that aim to reorient journalism towards our crisis situation, and along the way to ask whether the very idea of objectivity is still a useful guide for journalism in a world of crisis. Because in some ways, some aspects of the crisis in journalism, as well as the global crises, are worsened by journalism's regime of objectivity, which is a phrase that my colleague Yuzi Zhao and I used in a book about 12 years ago called Sustaining Democracy. It was our term for North American journalism's dominant paradigm during the 20th century. And it consists of normative goals, practices, an epistemology, that is a theory of knowledge that we can represent the world as it is, an institutional framework such as the separation of editorial and marketing functions, and the language of everyday talk about news. So it's a multifaceted paradigm, we argued, which we called the regime of objectivity. But that regime is now itself in trouble, both institutionally and in terms of critiques of its very assumptions. And we argue that some aspects of the objectivity regime will actually impede effective crisis communication at the same time as we need to preserve some aspects of the ideal and some of the practices of objectivity, as I'll describe as we go through. So Let me start with peace journalism. Can I ask how many people have previously heard of the concept of peace journalism? Perhaps a half of you? Well, that's good. It's making some headway then. Its most common definition is that peace journalism is when journalists make choices of what stories to report and about how to report them that create opportunities for society to consider and value nonviolent responses to conflict. That doesn't mean that journalism becomes a social movement. It has to maintain, I think, a certain sense of an observer status, a certain degree of independence from any particular organization or movement, and that's one aspect of objectivity that I think it should maintain. But it does mean that there is a conscious orientation towards searching for nonviolent ways to resolve conflict. So peace journalists, amongst other things, call attention to the context of conflicts. They avoid reducing conflict to two sides, one of which is typically demonized, and they pay more heed to peacemakers and the victims of war, and they will examine patterns of cultural and structural violence that often precede and underlie the physical violence of bombs and bullets. So peace journalism challenges the regime of objectivity in several ways. First, it challenges the epistemological, philosophical basis for a stance of detachment. In other words, journalists can and never are simply observers, value-neutral observers, and calls instead for journalists to be more reflective about the institutionalized biases of their routine practices, the inescapability of framing and sourcing choices, and so on. Secondly, peace journalism challenges dominant news values by emphasizing conflict formation and conflict resolution, on win-win positive outcomes, on long-term processes and contexts, and on grassroots sources, including both the victims of war and the peacemakers. Peace journalism challenges the news values of violence, negativity, unambiguity, timeliness, elite nations, and elite people. And thirdly, peace journalists explicitly challenge some of the practices of objectivity. They call for broadening the range of sources beyond the usual official suspects to consider, as I said, peacemakers and the victims of conflicts. They call for the construction, the representation of conflict as not simply a two-sided zero-sum matter in which one side's gain is the other side's loss. That's a construction that is related to the objectivity paradigm's notions of balance, which I think is something that needs to be rethought and to some extent discarded, in favor, in peace journalism, of focusing on multiple stakeholders and looking for win-win outcomes. And they also challenge dominant journalism's focus on timely events in favor of contexts, structures, and processes. But at the same time, I think you could argue that peace journalism draws upon the best aspects of the objectivity regime and the ideals of professional journalism, such as comprehensiveness, context, accuracy, the representation of the full range of relevant opinions, responsibility, and fairness. Another paradigm that's emerging, Robert Cox in the United States has done a good deal of work on this, is that of environmental communication, based on an ethical obligation to the public, such as enhancing society's ability to respond appropriately to environmental signals, to make decision-making processes transparent and accessible to the public, to engage various groups in understanding and interacting with the natural world, and to identify harmful or unsustainable policies and practices. And I think it's in somewhat the same relationship as is peace journalism to the regime of objectivity. It calls into question some of the assumptions and practices of objectivity, while at the same time wanting to preserve, for example, the ethos of truth-telling, and indeed an orientation towards some kinds of elite sources. I think environmental communication would be, you know, much better if journalists were more effectively to pay attention to what the scientists are telling us and to translate that, you know, the messages about climate change, for example, to broader audiences. So I'm going to pass it over to Pinar at this point.
Okay, so what are the implications for practice and policy of crisis-oriented journalism? We are saying that, arguing that crisis-oriented journalism can provide an avenue out of journalism's own crisis by increasing its relevance, by emphasizing the local initiatives and adaptations to crisis, and most importantly, by providing a sustained narrative. But crisis-oriented journalism also requires substantial changes in the daily news routines, in sourcing, in narrative practices, and in research. So a retraining, a focused retraining of journalists in journalism schools and in virtual and material newsrooms is necessary. We are also aware of the fact that crisis-oriented journalism that we described here is not compatible with some of the hegemonic practices and institutions in Canadian journalism today, and particularly its market-driven characteristics, because it's not it's difficult to commodify, and it doesn't reflect in market prices. Therefore, we suggest several avenues of change. The first one is democratic reform of communication and media policy to strengthen the legal and financial as well as institutional framework that would enable independent and quality journalism. And we mentioned two specific policy goals to do that. The first one is supporting the advocacy campaigns to maintain open, universal access to internet. The second one is the reinvigoration of public service broadcasting in a new media context. And meanwhile, in the meantime, support for community and alternative media. These two forms of media are very important because they empower citizens to tell their own stories, and they actually promote mobilization and engagement. And we consider them as excellent sites of experimentation and models for excellent journalism. Past and current Canadian media policy actually provides very good support mechanisms for community and alternative media. For example, there is shelf space in the license spectrum for community television, grants, and again, tax supports for Canadian magazines. But we think that in the current neoliberal political climate, we should maintain and extend these support mechanisms, but we cannot count on them alone. So that's why we would like to mention a particularly important community-based financing model for crisis-oriented journalism. It's called WaterMedia.org, and it's founded by Mark Latham in Vancouver, who is here today with us. You can
Mark,
actually... ask him your questions after the presentation. So it's a participatory budgeting process pioneered in Porto Alegre. It resembles to that participatory budgeting process pioneered in Porto Alegre, Brazil. And it envisages representative collective bodies that such as university student societies or municipal governments that empower voters to allocate a pool of money to competing individuals and institutions who produce civic media, including blogs. And the initial experiments actually suggest that they are very successful in stimulating media attention to civic issues as well as voter engagement with their media and political environments. So I'm moving on to our conclusion. Basically, in this presentation, we have advanced the argument that Canadian journalism is in a state of malaise or crisis, and one of the avenues to overcome this crisis is for journalism to redefine itself as a crisis-oriented discipline, self-reflexive discipline. And while doing that, journalism should discard some of the ossified practices of objectivity that hinder political engagement and understanding, while maintaining its commitment to public truth. And the underlying dilemma is that of reversing the Enlightenment rationale for democracy as an underpinning for ever-expanding individual freedom and progress. Paradoxically, now we need democracy to gain or acquire majority acquiescence to put a limit on those limits, on those freedoms that are exploitative, that are violence-generating, and that are destructive. And we need to manage the transition to a post-growth economy and a sustainable civilization because we have outgrown the carrying capacity of our planet. And thanks for listening to us.
Thank you very much for both of you. Alors, je vais maintenant inviter M. Greg Nielsen de l'Université Concordia. Avez-vous des...
Minutes
seems short, but there's an upcoming conference. It's called LACFAS, and they'll start with something. They'll start with a competition. They're calling it the 3-minute thesis. Doctoral students will have 3 minutes only to explain their thesis. So 10 minutes is a lot.
10 minutes is three times more than I used to get. I'm not a journalist. I've never been a journalist. I'll never be a journalist. And you guys that are journalists really impressed me. I've been following things around in journalism for about 5 or 6 years. Learned an enormous amount from my colleague Mike Gasher, Colette Brin, Chantal Francoeur, and Lisa Lynch, and many others. Yeah. Hello? You want me to use the mic, right? Okay. Speak louder, yeah. So I got started. I'm a critical sociologist. I'm trying to look at societies from the bottom up. And journalism caught my attention because I wanted to find out where are we speaking in the public place about social exclusion, and how does social exclusion work in liberal democracies that keep trying to find ways to cover up their mistakes and figure out how to integrate people and make difference work within a plurality of publics. So I got interested in that, and as I started looking at newspapers in the United States, it began to struck me that journalists are not sociologists or anthropologists. It really, really struck me heavy. And the question that kept coming up for me was not what journalism is for, or really trying to define journalism. Obviously, I'm not happy with the kind of democracy we have, but in some future democracy, we're going to need journalists that I would be happy with. So I asked the question, the critical question for a sociologist becomes, what's the relationship, in a sense, between the journalists and their audiences? And what's the gap when you're talking about social exclusion, poverty, homelessness, social divisions, the working poor, etc., or cultural diversity, newness, our shock from difference, or trying to deal with something like Bill 94, which came up in Quebec over the last three or four years to ban face covering in public institutions, this kind of retreat. Why is it that liberal democracies all over the world who've prided themselves on difference and accepting alterity seem to be retreating from that sort of sense of plurality? And I think journalism is at the heart of how liberal democracies cover up those things and cover up social exclusion and cover up social and cultural differences, or try and make things work. And so my interest, and I try to make it more systematic, is to say, well, who is it that the journalist is addressing? And when I look at an article from the New York Times where fathers from Panama or Mexico or China are running from house to house away from the immigration officials, and I read the article in the New York Times, I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. Even the fact that journalism is incredibly hospitable and has a very positive opening towards a moral and rational
issue about poverty or immigration and difficult issues around citizenship, even more so than the public opinion might express, they're not actually addressing the illegal, they're not actually addressing the undocumented person. They're not actually addressing the four or five guys that sleep outside the metro and it's minus 30 below. They want the story to address someone else. I don't think it's just the grandmother. I think the real addressee for the journalist is some kind of abstract demos for me, abstract sense of what the common readership is, an abstract sense of what the common normal people are. And so playing around that norm for a critical sociology like critical sociologists like me says, how do we begin to undo the norm? And so the research I've been working on and the kind of work I'm interested in is trying to theorize that relationship and that gap between what the subject that the journalist writes about and the audience that the journalist imagined he or she is addressing, and the gap between poverty and the experience of poverty and what the actual audience might understand about poverty, I'm going to call an interpretive or hermeneutic contradiction. And I think it's easy to see that the experience of difference, the young girl wearing a veil in a French class in Montreal, who's expelled from that class because the teacher can't see her face, and how that sort of shakes down the whole regime and establishment, is an experience that young girl has, and that we really get back in the press. My question is, what would happen if the journalist wrote the story in a way that the girl became the addressee and not the abstract common sense of a demos or a common normal people? And what would happen if it were those guys living outside the metro that were the addressee? And what would happen if journalism took up this radical position that the subjects of social exclusion and the difficult issues, thorny issues around citizenship regarding cultural differences, what happens if those agents were actually the addressees of the reports? And I'm in the middle of the research project, and we're finding through coding six or seven North American newspapers, kind of like a university in a way when you think about it. It's got everything in it. Well, it should. And I'm finding, you know, the results are slowly coming in. It's a long process. And we're coding them according to the kinds of sources that are used, the kinds of authorities that are used, how the bias is so much towards external sources to understand the chronic homelessness, chronic poverty, the debate on reasonable accommodation, particularly in Quebec, but also undocumented immigration in the United States. And so that external sense is also coupled with what I would expect, this sort of sense of a conditional kind of hospitality towards cultural diversity. Yes, you can wear veils, but not in the public place, or yes, you can, or the debate goes back and forth in that sort of way. Yes, we can support undocumented workers, but there should be some sort of process to bring them into full citizenship. So there's always a condition attached, because the addressee is never the actual person that we're speaking about. And so it's a kind of simple question, what I call a dialogic framework, how the writer implies an audience in their writing that does not necessarily include in any sort of primary way the subjects that they're reporting on. Comment est-ce que l'écrivain ou le journaliste va voir son destinataire dans une façon où le sujet du reportage est en quelque sorte exclué. Et puis, that's basically the very, very simple part of the research. I don't have a few more slides. I apologize to Christina and the organizers. I don't have super concrete policy issues for you to take. Keep going. I can do it. Super concrete policy issues to report to you or to deliver, in the sense that I've never been a bit of, what do you call that pejorative term? I've never been much of a policy wonk, but I think this conference is bringing me sort of into that, and I started to think about it, and I know that the research is telling me something that we need to undo acts of journalism, and acts of journalism, I understand pretty much in this hypothesis, that an act of journalism is, in a sense, where the journalist is situating himself vis-a-vis the implied audience and the relationship between that implied audience and the subjects of the report. So for me, and I'm really happy to follow Bob and his colleague's paper in the sense that I agreed pretty much with everything he says, and we need to shift a little bit from this, what we're calling this external, to more internal forms of sources, from constitutive to more performative kinds of journalism, from rational to more adversarial forms of journalism, from accuracy to increased editorial autonomy for journalists, and from balance to a bigger and harder, stronger commitment to your stories. That's as a sociologist speaking, of course. So it's easier said from the sociological point of view, from the doing as the journalist, right? So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Greg. You still had 30 seconds to go.
I can't read the whole book in 30 seconds.
Thanks for the effort. I'll now invite the people from Groundwire. I'm sorry, I did not. There's Candace and?
It's Annabelle.
Annabelle. Thank you very much, Groundwire.
Sure. So bonjour. Hi. Welcome, everyone. So first off, Groundwire, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, is a national community news program that's broadcasted over 30 community radio stations across Canada. And it was launched in 2008. Each edition is about 29 minutes long. And it's produced at a different community radio station each edition. So there's a rotating group of volunteers that takes on producing each program. And all the editions are posted online, so folks across the country can download it and broadcast it across whatever city or town they're in at different times. Regarding content, each edition includes headlines, feature stories. There's always a community radio report, some news from the sector, or spotlight on a community radio station, as well as it features music that's either Canadian or local to the producing station. As a form of alternative media, Groundwire stories focus on a wide range of social and environmental justice struggles. And Groundwire generally covers stories that, in that way, allow space for a critical analysis of what is often underrepresented or even, sometimes worse, misrepresented in other forms of media. In terms of the structure and process, the National Network of Community Radio Producers make up a collective that collectively governs the development and the sort of day-to-day process of producing each edition. And the story submissions come from all over the country, and the producing station will collect those, and their volunteers there will put together the edition by designing the sound and hosting and making sure it follows through with the regular format of the show. And that's pretty much the intro, just to give you an idea of what it is. I'll throw to Candace to give you a bit more information about the history of its inception.
And the website, by the way, is groundwire.ncra.ca. The program was officially launched in 2008, and the first edition was in Spanish. It was called Cable à Tierra. Then the second edition was in French, Ici AIR, and then the Anglophone production carried forward through the years. It was born out of many discussions preceding 2008. So for several years at national campus and community radio conferences that take place every June, hosted by different National Campus and Community Radio Association members, people come together, and there was a demand, there was a need for a national news program because a lot of stations were broadcasting Democracy Now, which is very American, and so we would love to make the program a daily newscast. We took a look at our capacity and our present resources, and we've been able to produce it biweekly, so every 2 weeks on volunteer labor for the most part. Originally, before it was called Groundwire, we referred to it mostly as the Community News Net of Canada. You want to talk about this?
Sure. So, I don't know if this, it just sounds like I'm kind of, am I speaking loud enough for people to hear?
Okay.
Is this better? That one seemed louder. That's okay. Okay, that seems a bit better. So the main points that we wanted to have come across in our paper is we outlined four specific practices that Groundwire uses to collectively build a national community news network that prioritizes public engagement, training, as well as localism. So the first one is we're based out of, as Candace just mentioned, a developmental history and governance structure that's aimed to be transparent and collaborative, as well as largely drawn from volunteer participation. So a lot of the Groundwire policy that you see, you can access it on the website, and what we'll be talking about today has been collected and developed by volunteer input. So not just folks on the steering collective of Groundwire, but people who contribute, people who have helped put it together across the country. The second practice is a collective production process. And as I mentioned earlier, it rotates between different community radio stations. But in addition to that, there's a focus on making sure it rotates between rural and urban campus and community radio stations, and fosters a collaborative work ethic. So there also have been stories where there'll be sources from different parts of the country, and people will help put together stories together. The importance of the collective production process is mostly in that people who didn't have any prior experience in journalism or broadcast media get to actually have this hands-on experience where they're working with other folks and actually sharing their skills and building new ones together. So it's not necessarily based on a specific professional standard of journalism, but it's sort of like an experimental ground, as Jean mentioned earlier, of people putting together what they feel is the most valuable to them. So those are two of the more structural things about Groundwire. The two practices that may be the most relevant to our panel and discussion today are Groundwire's editorial policy and the priority bureaus. These are things that make it quite unique. First off, the editorial policy defines principles of anti-oppression in addition to outlining new approaches to balance, integrity, and accuracy. There are several points. We outlined most of them in the paper if you're interested. But I'm going to highlight a couple of them that are particularly interesting. Groundwire's editorial policy outlines some programming priorities, as well as it's important to understand them as responsibilities. They include an attention to strengthening social justice movements locally and around the world, and promoting a critical analysis of the news. So of particular interest is the focus on self-representation as key to meaningful participation. So when we talk about public engagement, what does that mean? For example, like, who is the public? So that's sort of related to what was mentioned earlier. So what is a credible source? We have a variety of ways that we engage sources with Groundwire. So primary sources or those people who are directly affected by an issue are prioritized first. So that's always, you know, the thing that the voice that we want to include first off. And then as a secondary source, we might refer to people who are either involved in the issue or lastly informed on the issue. So usually you might see the opposite in mainstream media, so kind of experts first, people involved, and then folks on the ground sometimes aren't included or are just sort of your little soundbite. So we sort of flip that around. There's an example that we talk about. There's a non-narrative feature format that we practice, and that is, for example, we did a special on midwifery in Canada, and that feature spotlighted voices from midwives, mothers, as well as healthcare stakeholders, but didn't require a neutral reporter to facilitate that conversation. So that's an example of a non-narrative feature that focuses on just primary sources. A second way we engage sources is we encourage sources to contribute to the program in languages other than English. So the editorial policy notes on this point the importance of representing linguistic communities. So it says Groundwire is committed to featuring Aboriginal languages as often as possible, as an example, and often with whichever community radio station that is producing the program will refer to either the traditional territory's name or the name of the place in Aboriginal language, just as a form of respect or acknowledgement. And so thirdly, the way we engage with sources is sources can also be producers as well as trainees. So there is an example that Groundwire did a collaborative edition with a at-risk youth group called Flemo City Media based in Toronto. And basically the youth group there, they were the sources. They interviewed each other about issues that were relevant to them. They talked about their own program, and they also were the producers because they have a really great media program there. So they were actually the people who edited the audio and put it all together. Okay, so the last practice that I think is very important is that Groundwire clearly identifies priority bureaus, and that sort of highlights the social and environmental justice values of Groundwire. Some of them include, there's a list, I'll just name a few of them to give you an example. We've got migration, refugee, and newcomer issues, queer and trans voices, prison justice reporting, poverty and homelessness focus, disability and accessibility issues, as well as race and equity focuses. There's also more. So I kind of wanted to sort of frame this in a way that how I want to kind of have people think about this, and also something we've been thinking about, how these practices are meaningful to fostering a broad movement for community journalism as a strategic and transformative tool for social or environmental justice. So beyond just covering stories or from journalistic standpoint, making sure we include issues, how are the processes actually working to transform the way people understand journalism or people understand media? Okay. So I was trying to keep it short. But did you want to add anything, Candace? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Candace and Annabelle. Merci beaucoup. Muchas gracias. Niawen. Now I'll turn to, Mr. Robert Washburn, who's going to talk to us about, if you wish, you can use your volume. Do you have a presentation? No? Okay. Could we make your
consider,
website come up?
Consider this hyphen. Mm-hmm. consider-this.ca. Yes, please. Thank you very much. The funny thing is I teach technology in the program, e-journalism, and I decided that I would just do an old-fashioned journalistic thing and tell a story instead, so that's it. No, it's not what you think. I want to keep my clothes on, but it was just some thoughts about last night's panel. This is now reverted back into being my blog. What I'm about to describe is a little different. It's not unusual at a journalism conference to focus on the big picture, policies, issues, problems around mainstream news media in large urban centers, CBC, the Globe and Mail, and so forth. Reminds me of walking through a beautiful garden and our eyes gravitate toward the largest plants or the most brilliant colors. Yet there are many smaller plants that are very beautiful and important, which share the landscape. It is crucial in our discussions not to forget the smaller media, especially in rural Canada, which plays a vital role in a community's life and within the news industry's ecosystem. If all politics are local, then so is journalism. As new and emerging technologies continue to globalize the production and consumption of news, the importance of local news found at the grassroots levels in communities across Canada cannot be lost. While the news industry struggles to remain viable, its efforts to find efficiency and cost-effective solutions must not blind it to the values of news within the local context. My submission, Journalism on the Ground in Rural Ontario, The Viability of Hyperlocal News, is about research done over a one-year period to explore hyperlocal news as an alternative news vehicle for underserved communities, particularly those in rural Canada. I see great potential to revitalize journalism within communities via online platforms using new and emerging technologies, both professional and citizen journalists. There are many challenges, but there are also many successes. So let me share my story. To begin, I go back quite far, about 2 years ago, when I did a survey of the 777 members of the Canadian Community Newspaper Association, now part of the Canadian Newspaper Canada, looking at all the newspaper websites. The vast majority, more than 90%, reflect a regional approach to their coverage. Obviously, this is done for economic reasons, since the operations need a large and diverse market to draw advertisers. What struck me was how this approach failed to recognize the full potential of the online platform. While a small newspaper might not survive in print, a regional one could be broken down into various communities focusing on individual towns, villages, hamlets, with little or no additional cost. At the same time, the publications could make stronger connections to the audience. In some cases, it would be traditional relationships dating back to the 19th century. Somehow, this was lost on the publishers. At the same time all this was running through my head, I began to notice this emerging trend called hyperlocal news. At first, like so many people, I thought, oh, this is just community newspapers online. Somebody's just trying to redefine an old idea. But the more I explored these ideas and the examples of hyperlocal news, the more I began to understand how it is different and why it is significant. Hyperlocal news is not just about covering small geographic areas. It's an expression of an attitude. It is not just about covering potholes or check presentations, but about providing a voice for a neighborhood, a hamlet, a village, or a town, or even a small city. Content centers on important local issues as defined by the community. And unlike community news media, which is tightly tied to dominant mainstream media, both in terms of economics and editorial content, hyperlocal news is a range of community-based activities aimed at supplementing, challenging, and/or changing the operating principles, structures, financing, and cultural forms and practices of journalism in the news industry. Now, how exciting is that? So here I was thinking about all these great ideas, and along comes the Ontario municipal election in the fall of 2010. Now I run a blog called Consider This, and on the night of the election on October 25th, 2010, I created a panel to hold an online discussion on the election results using a live blog. I invited a few key community members and a former political staffer for the federal and provincial Liberals and a retired community activist. Both were high-profile and well-known local local politics. It was promoted via social media, and at the time, there was no particular research objective in mind. Well, what could have easily turned out to be a snoring, boring event turned into one of the most exciting. You see, there was a problem with the online voting system used by the municipal returning officer that crashed just before the polls closed as people piled online to cast their ballots at the last minute. Since the local media were not reporting on this very well, while the events unfolded, a member of the discussion group decided to take their laptop and a remote internet turbo stick, which gives them internet access anywhere, to go down to town hall and find out what was going on so they could report back to the online discussion group. Well, it turned out the online voting was extended by an hour, and if people were patient, the system would be rebooted and they could cast their ballots. This was reported back to our online group, and before long, it came on local radio, which was the most immediate reporting done that night. Meanwhile, local newspapers and their websites reported nothing. The impact of this coverage was felt instantly. The audience shared its frustrations with the online voting crisis. One woman wrote an email of appreciation afterwards saying coverage via the live blog meant that she was able to learn of the voting deadline change. This allowed her to go online and cast a ballot. It's an excellent example of the direct impact. For me, this was hyper-local news in action. This was so inspiring, I formally drafted a plan using an action research model and undertook a year-long project to convert, consider this, into a hyper-local news site. Working as the lone professional journalist, I was joined by several citizen journalists. We provided weekly live blogs of town council meetings, regular commentary provided by community activists on social justice issues, and ongoing news coverage of local politics and hard news, largely undercovered by the other mainstream media and online community. Another aspect of the research was to look at the use of emerging and new technologies to help facilitate the journalism. This meant the use of free open source software and online services, along with native software found on equipment, rather than purchasing expensive high-end tools. Economic viability is a critical issue. However, it was felt in the limited resources of the study that it would be a burden to try and add this dimension on top of the already heavy load of the current research plans. Certainly, the subject of economic viability was given extensive theoretical treatment, but it was not included in the practicum aspects of this project. The project was constructed in late 2010 and got off the ground in January 2011. The peak activity was between April and September, mainly because the academic year had ended and my own time was more open to provide news coverage. From September to November, it continued with limited news coverage, regular live blogs of town council meetings, and contributions from citizen journalists. The contribution of citizen journalists was essential. Of the top five hits during the entire life of the project, three were by citizen journalists. The live blog coverage of council meetings and a parking story rounded out the top five list. This was also borne out via social media, where the most shared stories on Twitter and Facebook were three stories done by citizen journalists on welfare reform. The federal election, which was held in May 2011, received the highest combination of most page views and the longest average time spent on a single page, making it a highlight for the project. A total of 18,063 page views took place over the length of the project, with one-third being regular returning visitors. The average time spent on the site was 1 minute 56 seconds. A survey of local politicians, community opinion leaders, and municipal staff was completed as part of the action research methodology to seek input from stakeholders. All of the 27 respondents used traditional community newspapers as a source for news. Half consulted social media for local news, which I found was a surprise. During the project, the majority visited the site, but only 20% used it daily. Half admitted blogs, online news sources, including social media, influenced them in decision-making. Without question, local news coverage was considered important to the community. Notably, 97% of respondents said online was an important source for the community. Finally, two-thirds said hyper-local news sites like Consider This will be important to the future of community news. I would like to make several recommendations. One, For hyperlocal news to be successful, national journalism organizations like the Canadian Association of Journalists, the Canadian Journalism Foundation, the Canadian News Association, RTNDA must acknowledge it as a category for professional development and awards. I am pleased to say I'm on a panel next week on hyperlocal news at the Inc. and Beyond Conference in Toronto. Governments can create programs similar to the Local Programming Improvement Fund to assist hyperlocal operations. It was successful in expanding local coverage for TV news and could be applied to radio, newspapers, and online. Third, the creation of an online incubator to help journalists get started producing hyperlocal news sites. I'm looking for partners. Cooperative efforts between academic institutions, the news industry, and government could be created to provide editorial support, technical training, business development counseling, and links between communities who are looking for news outlets and journalists. Four, enlarging the reach of regional economic development programs to include non-traditional areas like news media. These mainly tend to focus on manufacturing and retail. And finally, the formation of an advertising cooperative like the Ontario Community Newspaper Association program AdReach for hyperlocal news sites in order to target advertisers wanting to reach communities directly. In other words, it would help create hyperlocal marketing opportunities for these businesses. Hyperlocal news is a potential alternative for underserved communities in Canada. The research presented in this summary provides some basis for optimism in the face of serious challenges. The Consider This project represents a solid first step in identifying the challenges and wrestling with solutions in the context of a rural community. The use of new and emerging technologies provides practical tools and potential platforms for the effective and cost-efficient creation and distribution of news. With sufficient support by industry and governments, hyperlocal news could flourish more quickly and more rapidly than if it was left alone to find its own way within the confusing, often contradictory efforts of large mainstream urban news conglomerates. Innovative approaches like independently owned hyperlocal news sites might be drowned out by bigger, better financed, and higher profile initiatives that do not address the social and cultural needs of communities. They cannot connect in the same manner. Canadians living in rural areas, along with those who living in identifiable neighborhoods within large urban centers, could find hyperlocal news a viable alternative. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Washburn. So now, I'm sure all those presentations sparked a lot of questions. In your minds, it certainly sparked a lot in mine. But I'll leave the questions for the floor. And usually, questions come from a mic in the room. Oh, there is a mic, right? Okay. So what I will do is, if you have a question, please ask for the mic and please identify yourself. Si vous avez une question à poser, je vais demander d'appeler le microphone, de vous identifier et aussi de préciser. De bien préciser à qui s'adresserait votre question. Et il est 10h02. La conférence, on se donne 15 minutes. C'est jusqu'à 10h15 que la conférence va durer, mais on se donne 15 minutes. À vous la parole.
Hi, my name is Paul Knox from Ryerson University in Toronto. Question for Professor Nielsen. You said you were about halfway through, and first of all, I was very interested. I always think it's great when people actually look really closely and really seriously at journalism that is actually done, as opposed to the sort of conception of what we think journalism is or does. But I have one question, that is, does your research design involve talking to the journalists who write these stories? Are you going to do interviews?
No.
Well, okay.
What I want to do, the second half will be The second half will be working with focus groups and journalism students to rewrite stories and try and penetrate the mainstream. That's the plan. But, you know, it's kind of a... So I'm not interested in doing an ethnography at the moment, but, I don't mean to say that I shouldn't. And if I wanted to study what journalism actually is and really get a good handle on that, you need to do that. That's true. But I'm interested in changing journalism.
to change, well, to sort of reverse Mark's comment last night and the panel, to change journalism to create social change, which is different, I think, than journalism as social change.
Can I ask, then, are you confident that the people who are writing these stories that you're looking at don't share that vision?
Oh, I never thought of it. It's not important to me. It's what's important to me is to establish an act of journalism that will shift the model. And how do you do that? Well, I just figure you start with teaching people about this. You start with talking about this. You start with an active way. I don't think I can go into a newsroom and convince anybody of anything, right? But some student in 10 years might, or some group might emerge. So the goal of a project is to complete that experiment with rewriting stories towards another addressee and figuring out, can we get an editor to sit in on a meeting? And can we make one little step? That's what it is.
Yeah, it's naive. I just don't understand how you can be so sure that those people, I mean, you think the stories are addressed one way.
Yeah.
What was in their mind when they were writing the stories?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we've just had this story, a study out of Calgary, the one that looks at the coverage of the homeless.
Right.
And talks about, you know, how the voices of the homeless, quote, and, you know, the word homeless is in quotes, of course, because it's a controversial term, but how their voices are excluded or are permitted only for certain purposes. But the voices of the journalists who actually wrote those stories are actually completely, utterly absent from the study.
Right.
And I'm always a little bemused at, you know, studies of journalism that talk about exclusion and then exclude the voices of journalists.
Ironic comment, but a just one, I think. Yeah, sure. Like, we can only do so much in one project. Yeah.
Hmm. Interesting point, Mr. Knox. Thank you very much. On a note, right behind you.
Okay. Marie-Ève Paradis, I'm a freelance journalist, and I'm a VP of LAGIC, l'Association des journalistes indépendants du Québec. A question to Mr. Washburn. Knowing that many rural communities don't have access to high-speed internet, how do we do this kind of initiative, which is great? I would love to do that, actually. I would love to be, as a journalist, part of hyper-local experience. But that, my first question is high-speed internet, and how can we be, how can we earn our life being a journalist in hyper-local news?
Thank you very much. First of all, there are initiatives underway in many provinces to provide high-speed access in rural areas. So I sort of hope to ride that wave out into the wilderness. But I also think in various platforms. We can't just think of internet solely as something that comes across a wire. Smartphones are another example, and that would be a platform that could deliver news in areas where internet isn't currently available. So I don't think that's an insurmountable problem. I think it just takes some creative thinking. Economic viability is a huge topic, and the quick answer is that yes, you can make a living, but it's not going to be the sort of Facebook sells for a gajillion dollars or Instagram sells for a billion. You're going to be just like the good old-fashioned 19th century publishers. You know, you're going to go in, you're going to do everything, and you're going to make a living. And that might not be a great living. It'll be a modest living. And I haven't actually done a practicum on that, but I can talk to several models. I know the Minnesota Post is a great example of a mixed model, uses foundation money, does subscription drives, fundraises, all different kinds of things. I've seen examples where a small community, a hamlet, the local church was the sponsor of the news. And they had a committee, they raised money, and they paid for an operation totally editorially independent, but it was for the community. And I think that's why I like this idea of an incubator, to be able to help provide business support for people like yourself who are interested in doing this and looking at the various models. I don't think there's a silver bullet. I don't think it'll ever be one model. It'll be one way in the Annapolis Valley, and it'll be another way in Prince George, and another way in Inuvik. You know, it's just going out there and being prepared to do whatever it takes to make it come together. But I do know it'll come together. If I can just tell a quick story. Mm-hmm. There is a hyperlocal site in a place called Colborne, which if anybody drives the Highway 401 in eastern Ontario, it's the place where the Big Apple is. So when you go by the Big Apple, the village that's in is called Colborne. There is a hyperlocal news operation. I did some interviews with sponsors, and this one advertiser was a real estate salesman. And I said to him, why do you advertise? He says, well, I know I'm never going to sell a house on this site, but it's good for the community. And I think there are lots of reasons in these smaller areas for people to be supportive. I think it's a whole different mind shift, and I think we have to adapt to that. Mm-hmm. Does that help?
Great. I would expand on that, Mr. Washburn. Yeah, keep your microphone, because I want to. One of the questions that sparked refers to the Payette report. People who were there yesterday have seen Dominique Payette was there, and one of the recommendations that she did on the state of the media in Quebec she advocated for public money to support community-based media. What do you think of that?
I think, as I mentioned in my recommendation, something similar to the community initiative for television could be applied to online as well. Mm-hmm. I also think having an incubator that was government sponsored to help people get started and get going, and once they get going and once they make the connections to the community and find the economic models that will work within that particular community, then they'd be set to go. That's another approach that could be used. I think it's just a matter of really being creative. And there's just so many. There's countless, I can think of so many different examples. I don't want to take a lot of time with this, but there are different ways of doing it. And, you know, subscription-based, community-based. I mean, you think about it. Small town like I live in, $300 for a year-long subscription to the community newspaper. You know, give me half of that, and I'm away. Mm-hmm. You know? And I think it's just people rethinking how they want to do it. So. Okay.
And on the Mrs. Payette's recommendation, I also wanted to ask maybe Annabelle and Constance, what do you think of that? Would you take public money to support ground wire?
Yes.
Closed question, short answer.
The way Groundwire is funded, it's very dependent on the way the individual radio stations are funded, and so often the money comes from student levies on campuses, listener-supported funding drives, and advertising, and so there's very little public support. Right now, Groundwire is hiring someone to look into sponsorship models, that sort of thing. So, yeah, we're always looking to diversify our revenue stream so that we're not dependent on one particular funding stream.
Okay. I guess the question also could be asked to Mr. Hackett. Would that be also public money, public support? Would that be something you would advocate?
Yes, I think that was part of, implicit at least, in what we said about support for democratic media reform. We have a number of precedents already in Canadian public policy to do precisely that, is the point we're making. As long as it's done, obviously, at an arm's length relationship. It can't be, you don't want governments obviously acting as censors or as choosing to favor one source or one organization over another. There has to be a sort of politics-free formula to do that.
Another question from the floor? Hold on for the mic.
Oh, you're sorry.
Yeah, we hear you.
The tables are turned. I just wondered what your thoughts were on people being full-time or part-time journalists on that local level. Whether you think it devalues their work or if it compromises their journalism to, say, work at the building supply center or work as a butcher or whatever, and then subsidize their journalism through other work.
I know one project where the guy delivers pizza at night and works as a journalist during the day. And I think I don't see a problem with that. I mean, he believes obviously in his project and his product and is working to make it come through. He hopes to make it self-sustaining within the next 2 years. I know there was another project down in Picton in Prince Edward County, Ontario, where it took them 2 years waiting before they became profitable, and they did other things while they moved towards profitability. So I don't think it's an unusual approach. Does that help?
Where was that, the pizza?
The pizza? a place called Roseneath, Ontario, runs a website called northumberlandview.ca. Mm-hmm. And he delivered pizza at night and on the weekends and ran his site and went out and marketed it during the day.
Une autre question ici?
Hi, Iva Shapiro Reyes, and a question really to any of our speakers. Past session title is Working Definitions, and I'm wondering, what is your working definition of a journalist?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Who would like to start?
I try mm-hmm. to say, at least I'm interested in understanding what a journalist, what defines a journalism is the act of journalism. And that's very complex. It's got many different versions and genre of writing. So I focus on journalism is an act that anticipates a response from an audience. And when there's a gap between the audience and what the journalist is doing, there's a problem. What the journalism is reporting about, there's a problem. And that's the focus of the research I'm working on. So for me, journalism is an act.
Sorry, I need to ask you to clarify that. Journalism is any act that anticipates a response from an audience?
No. An act of journalism is when we go to report an event towards an audience, to report an event that includes subjects.
Information gathering.
Yes.
And
yes.
Reporting?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
That would be it.
Can I just like to address that, because I actually was asked to address that very question for a court case using the Charter of Rights in Alberta last year, a challenge to Alberta's Privacy Act, on the grounds that the Privacy Act prohibits the publication of private information or images of people except when committed for purposes of journalism and no other purpose. So the whole case hinges on how you define journalism, and is that a legitimate kind of exclusion? Mm. And so I was forced to go through the literature to answer that question. And I suppose in the literature, the sort of dominant components would include the idea of reportage or commentary. It's not simply reportage. Journalism is broader than news. The idea of public significance, messages of public significance on contemporary events or issues. Intended for dissemination and publication. So the idea of a public is inherent to journalism. So those, I think, are traditional components. But even using that traditional definition, it's very hard to define and confine who is a journalist and who is not. And therefore, I think they're going to argue that it's such a fuzzy notion that you can't really use that as the basis for an exclusion under an act that otherwise applies to everybody.
But that definition would include social media.
Yes, it could well do so. I mean, it certainly would include citizen journalism, right? It cannot be confined. I think, arguably, it wouldn't be fair to confine it to traditional or professional journalists and news organizations.
Mr. Washburn would like to take the answer. And that would be the last intervention. I'm sorry, it's 17 past 10.
I wouldn't pretend to try and take on all the complexity of this, but there's two points I'd like to make. I think traditional journalism, as it was practiced, was meant to inform, explain, and interpret events. And I argue in my work that I think that those principles are shifting now towards educate, engage, and empower. And that's part of the work that we've been doing down at Loyalist College. And I think the old hegemonic relationships are dying. And truly what we need to be doing is looking at how we, an educational aspect to journalism where we're teaching people and we do it as a model of sharing information and sharing ideas and gathering and collecting knowledge. that we engage people using the new tools that are before us, and that our goal is ultimately to empower them, to be a springboard for them into action. The second thing I would like to say is that I also think entrepreneurial journalism, where we are becoming more entrepreneurial, that we're not just limited to being the toilers, that we can actually go back, I guess, back to the future, which is to be the guys that roll the ink and set the type and pull the handle as the paper hits the ink and do all that great stuff, but we do it in a more modern way.
Merci beaucoup. Thanks a lot. Well, alors voici ce qui conclut notre panel de ce matin. Je remercie infiniment tous les conférenciers d'être venus d'aussi loin, hein, dans certains cas, pour partager vos idées, vos recherches avec nous. Merci au public. Je suis certain que la conversation va se poursuivre pendant le break. Et je vous invite à l'autre conférence qui commence à 10h45, ici même, toujours. Bonne pause.